15. Benbow reached his sister's home in the middle of the afternoon. It was 4 miles from town, Jefferson. He and his sister were born in Jefferson, 7 years apart, in a house which they still owned, though his sister had wanted to sell the house when Benbow married the divorced wife of a man named Mitchell and moved to Kinston. Benbow would not agree to sell, though he had built a new bungalow in Kinston on borrowed money upon which he was still paying interest. When he arrived, there was no one about. He entered the house, and he was sitting in the dim parlor behind the closed blinds when he heard his sister come down the stairs, still unaware of his arrival. He made no sound. She had almost crossed the parlor door and vanished when she paused and looked full at him, without outward surprise, with that serene and stupid impregnability of heroic statuary. She was in white. "Oh, Horace," she said. He did not rise. He sat with something of the air of a guilty small boy. "How did you?" he said. "Did Bell?" "Of course. She wired me Saturday that you had left, and if you came here, to tell you that she had gone back home to Kentucky and had sent for little Bell." "Oh, damnation," Benbow said. "Why?" his sister said. "You want to leave home yourself, but you don't want her to leave?" He stayed at his sister's 2 days. She had never been given to talking. Living a life of serene vegetation like perpetual corn or wheat in a sheltered garden instead of a field, and during those 2 days she came and went about the house with an air of tranquil and faintly ludicrous tragic disapproval. After supper, they sat in Miss Jenny's room, where Narcissa would read the Memphis paper before taking the boy off to bed. When she went out of the room, Miss Jenny looked at Benbow. "Go back home, Horace," she said. "Not to Kinston," Benbow said. "I hadn't intended to stay here, anyway. It wasn't Narcissa I was running to. I haven't quit one woman to run to the skirts of another." "If you keep on telling yourself that, you may believe it someday," Miss Jenny said. "Then what'll you do?" "You're right," Benbow said. "Then I'd have to stay at home." His sister returned. She entered the room with a definite air. "Now for it," Benbow said. His sister had not spoken directly to him all day. "What are you going to do, Horace?" she said. "You must have business of some sort there in Kinston that should be attended to." "Even Horace must have," Miss Jenny said. "What I want to know is why he left. Did you find a man under the bed, Horace?" "No such luck," Benbow said. "It was Friday, and all of a sudden I knew that I could not go to the station and get that box of shrimp, and..."
"But you have been doing that for 10 years, his sister said.
"I know. That's how I know that I will never learn to like smelling shrimp."
"Was that why you left Bell?"
Miss Jenny said. She looked at him.
"It took you a long time to learn that if a woman don't make a very good wife for one man, she ain't likely to for another, didn't it?"
"But to walk out just like a nigger," Narcissa said, "and to mix yourself up with moonshiners and streetwalkers..."
"Well, he's gone and left the streetwalker, too," Miss Jenny said. "Unless you're going to walk the streets with that orange stick in your pocket until she comes to town."
"Yes," Benbow said. He told again about the three of them, himself and Goodwin and Tommy, sitting on the porch, drinking from the jug and talking, and Popeye lurking about the house, coming out from time to time to ask Tommy to light a lantern and go down to the barn with him, and Tommy wouldn't do it, and Popeye would curse him, and Tommy sitting on the floor, scouring his bare feet on the boards with a faint hissing noise, chortling,
"Ain't he a sight now?"
"You could feel the pistol on him just like you knew he had a navel," Benbow said. "He wouldn't drink because he said it made him sick to his stomach like a dog. He wouldn't stay and talk with us. He wouldn't do anything, just lurking about, smoking his cigarettes like a sullen and sick child. Goodwin and I were both talking. He had been a cavalry sergeant in the Philippines and on the border, and in an infantry regiment in France. He never told me why he changed, transferred to infantry, and lost his rank. He might have killed someone, might have deserted. He was talking about Manila and Mexican girls and that half-wit chortling and glugging at the jug and shoving it at me. Take some more. And then I knew that the woman was just behind the door listening to us. They are not married. I know that, just like I know that that little black man had that flat little pistol in his coat pocket. But she's out there doing a nigger's work that's owned diamonds and automobiles, too, in her day, and bought them with a harder currency than cash. And that blind man, that old man sitting there at the table waiting for somebody to feed him, with that immobility of blind people, like it was the backs of their eyeballs you looked at while they were hearing music you couldn't hear. That Goodwin led out of the room and completely off the earth, as far as I know. I never saw him again. I never knew who he was, who he was kin to. Maybe not to anybody. Maybe that old Frenchman that built the house 100 years ago didn't want him either, and just left him there when he died or moved away. The next morning, Benbow got the key to the house from his sister and went into town. The house was on a side street, unoccupied now for 10 years. He opened the house, drawing the nails from the windows. The furniture had not been moved. In a pair of new overalls with mops and pails, he scoured the floors. At noon, he went downtown and bought bedding and some tinned food. He was still at work at 6 o'clock when his sister drove up in her car. "Come on home, Horace," she said. "Don't you see you can't do this?" "I found that out right after I started," Benbow said. "Until this morning, I thought that anybody with one arm and a pail of water could wash a floor." "Horace," she said. "I'm the oldest, remember?" he said. "I'm going to stay here. I have some cover." He went to the hotel for supper. When he returned, his sister's car was again in the drive. The Negro driver had brought a bundle of bed clothing. "Miss Narcissus, they for you to use them," the Negro said. Benbow put the bundle into a closet and made a bed with the ones which he had bought. Next day at noon, eating his cold food at the kitchen table, he saw through the window a wagon stop in the street. 3 women got down, and standing on the curb, they made unabashed toilets, smoothing skirts and stockings, brushing one another's back, opening parcels and donning various finery. The wagon had gone on. They followed on foot, and he remembered that it was Saturday. He removed the overalls and dressed and left the house. The street opened into a broader one. To the left, it went onto the square. The opening between 2 buildings, black with a slow, continuous throng, like 2 streams of ants, above which the cupola of the courthouse rose from a clump of oaks and locusts covered with ragged snow. He went on toward the square. Empty wagons still passed him, and he passed still more women on foot, black and white, unmistakable by the unease of their garments, as well as by their method of walking. Believing that town dwellers would take them for town dwellers, too, not even fooling one another. The adjacent alleys were choked with tethered wagons, the teams reversed and nuzzling gnawed corn ears over the tailboards. The square was lined 2 deep with ranked cars, while the owners of them and of the wagons thronged in slow overalls and khaki, in mail-order scarves and parasols, in and out of the stores, soiling the pavement with fruit and peanut hulls. Slow as sheep they moved, tranquil, impassible, filling the passages, contemplating the fretful hurrying of those in urban shirts and collars with the large, mild inscrutability of cattle or of gods, functioning outside of time having left time lying upon the slow and imponderable land green with corn and cotton in the yellow afternoon. Horace moved among them, swept here and there by the deliberate current, without impatience. Some of them he knew. Most of the merchants and professional men remembered him as a boy, a youth, a brother lawyer. Beyond a foamy screen of locust branches, he could see the dingy second-story windows where he and his father had practiced, the glass still innocent of water and soap as then, and he stopped now and then and talked with them in unhurried backwaters. The sunny air was filled with competitive radios and phonographs in the doors of drug and music stores. Before these doors, a throng stood all day listening. The pieces which moved them were ballads, simple in melody and theme, of bereavement and retribution and repentance, metallically sung, blurred, emphasized by static or needle, disembodied voices blaring from imitation wood cabinets or pebble-grain horn mouths above the rapt faces, the gnarled slow hands long shaped to the imperious earth, lugubrious, harsh, and sad. That was Saturday, in May. No time to leave the land. Yet on Monday they were back again, most of them, in clumps about the courthouse and the square, and trading a little in the stores since they were here, in their khaki and overalls and collarless shirts. All day long a knot of them stood about the door to the undertaker's parlor, and boys and youths, with and without schoolbooks, leaned with flattened noses against the glass. And the bolder ones and the younger men of the town entered in twos and threes to look at the man called Tommy. He lay on a wooden table, barefoot, in overalls, the sun-bleached curls on the back of his head matted with dried blood and singed with powder, while the coroner sat over him, trying to ascertain his last name. But none knew it, not even those who had known him for 15 years about the countryside, nor the merchants who on infrequent Saturdays had seen him in town, barefoot, hatless, with his rapt, empty gaze and his cheek bulged innocently by a peppermint jawbreaker. For all general knowledge, he had none.